Welcome to Iconography, a podcast about the geography of icons, real and imagined. Since I am a very freshly minted newlywed, I haven't quite had all the time I'd wanted to craft the new episode on Piccadilly Circus, so instead, I thought I'd give you a chance this week to hear where it is that iconography sort of came from. Back in 2015, I dedicated the Halloween episode of my previous podcast, Context Sensitive, to Guillermo del Toro's misunderstood Crimson Peak. Now, as you'll hear, the context explored, it actually has a lot of similarities to what I'm doing today on iconography. I looked at what distinguishes British ghost stories from American ones, and also at how del Toro turned the subtext of Gothic romance, a la Jane Eyre, into text by making the ghosts of the past into very strikingly real ghosts. There are definitely spoilers ahead, so if you haven't seen Crimson Peak before, it's actually debuting on HBO this month. See? I keep things timely. I hope you enjoy the iTunes debut of Phantasmagorier.
And the sheriff has shown up many times, and the last time they were about to shoot the door open because through the glass they could see a dead woman. It's Linda Blair from The Exorcist. I watch TV with her. I have her life-size in the sofa watching the TV, and they said the lady is not reacting. I said, she's not reacting because she's made of silicone.
That mellifluous accent belongs to director Guillermo del Toro. He's on Kimmel promoting his new film, Crimson Peak. In addition to doing the rounds on the interview circuit, del Toro has just started tweeting, which is awesome because del Toro is pretty much first on the list of film personalities you'd want to see 120-word blasts from on a regular basis. Del Toro is like if the back catalog of famous monsters of filmland gained sentience and signed up for social media. You just want to know, what is this man reading and watching? What new horror movie icon is he installing in statue form at the house he has set aside solely for his elaborate collections and obsessions?
You have so much stuff that you and your family had
a separate home.
The toys took over.
Yeah, the toys took over two houses with secret passages, a rain room where it rains 7 days a week.
It's one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
It's fun.
Del Toro's first recurring tweet series is called Righting a Wrong. In it, del Toro points out a film which has a certain reputation, forgotten, misunderstood, and argues for its proper place in the canon. An example, Righting a Wrong, Catch Me If You Can by Steven Spielberg. Huge pedigree, I know, but it should be acknowledged as top tier and not just a curio. Maybe del Toro is feeling a bit defensive of misunderstood films because his latest, Crimson Peak, is already in the process of becoming one. Even though del Toro has said this in just about every interview he's given,
Crimson Peak is not a horror film, it's a gothic romance. Big difference.
Crimson Peak has been called out repeatedly for not being scary enough, as in this flippant social media post from Entertainment Weekly. Crimson Peak is so preoccupied with being visually stunning, it forgets to be scary. Admittedly, it's hard to take anything EW posts on social media too seriously. 1 week after posting about Crimson Peak, the social media team broke the news that Khloe Kardashian and Kendrick Lamar would not be getting a divorce, to the consternation of many a commenter, as well as in all likelihood the editor of EW, who had just spent a whole week running high-profile stories on an ailing Lamar Odom. So yeah, quote, it forgets to be scary is such a horrible way to put it, but EW's actual critic, Chris Nashawadi, doesn't ever actually frame his dissatisfaction with Crimson Peak in that way, so, you know, semantics. But that sense that a filmmaker of del Toro's caliber, that the guy who made Pan's Labyrinth, somehow didn't realize he'd failed to make an appropriately scary movie, as if he absent-mindedly left all his jump scares back at the editing bay, perfectly encapsulates the condescension this film has experienced out of the gate. What does it say about what we expect from horror cinema in 2015 that a film which is begging publicly not to be graded based on its scare quotient is deemed not terrifying enough? That it is met with cries that it is, as the boisterous theater patron who stopped me after my showing to voice his disappointment put it, the biggest waste of money ever, 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 ever. Maybe it's a failure to communicate. Do we as a culture not have the context anymore to understand what del Toro means when he calls his film a gothic romance? Based on the channels from which most people get their information on upcoming films, do we even hear his plea? All that and more on this episode. We'll dive backwards in time and take a look at how the ghost story has evolved, and then we'll hop forward in time wondering what became of the Gothic romance. Context Sensitive is a podcast that looks at a major cultural milestone and wonders, how did we get to this moment, and what does it mean that we're here? I'm Charles Gustine, and the big question I'm setting out to wrestle in this, our second episode, is... whoever said Crimson Peak was going to be scary? I'm afraid of the ghosts. I hear it likes the ghosts. I'm afraid of the ghosts.
Ghosts are real. That much I know. I've seen them all my life.
Well, to some extent, the answer to the big question is depressingly simple. Whoever said Crimson Peak was going to be scary? The film's marketing did.
What was that?
A house as old as this one becomes, in time, a living thing.
Never go below this level.
Well, there we go. Podcast episode over. Thanks for listening in. Context sensitive. Alright, well, hold on. Actually, I do still have a few questions. Why did Universal feel they needed to go this direction to market Crimson Peak?
What do you want?
Because, as Rebecca Pale at Pajiba points out, a studio was essentially damning its own movie to being despised by pretty much everyone the trailers pulled in. You had a really good movie out this week, Universal. You took a gothic romance and made trailers for it that presented it as a generic horror film, and then you stand there all Kevin McAllister and Home Alone face when people go to a movie that they reasonably expect to be scary, and it's not scary. Crimson Peak was never supposed to be scary. Creepy? Yes. Atmospheric? Yes. Mysterious? Yes. Scary? No! It's an R-rated Jane Eyre with a few ghosts and Tom Hiddleston's ass. Look, I get that the audience for R-rated gothic romance is a lot smaller than the one for horror movie with ghosts. Scary! And I get wanting the largest amount of people to be interested in your movie prior to its release. But when people go in expecting a horror movie and are instead presented with a first half hour that's straight out of Bronte, a lot of them are going to be disappointed. And your reviews might suck, and word of mouth will be bad, and no one wins except the dark shaman whose purpose in life it apparently is to keep Guillermo del Toro from making things. Crimson Peak is actually Del Toro's second spin through the phantasmagorical realm. His first ghost movie, in which ghosts weren't really the point, was the deeply sad Spanish-language period piece, The Devil's Backbone. It was made 14 years ago, when his films only needed to court a boutique audience. The audience that would go see deeply sad Spanish-language period pieces. Accordingly, the trailer has its scary moments, but even without dialogue, conveys much about the film's complex mood and setting. Films that court that boutique audience, recent small market success stories like The Babadook and It Follows, can use more innovative strategies to relay their own very particular cocktails of dread, suspense, and eeriness. But films that are playing at the high rollers table, like Crimson Peak with its absurd for a horror film $55 million budget, end up having to up the ante in accordance with the other players at the table. And for the past 6 years, the surest way to get butts in seats has been to do what Paranormal Activity did in order to become the most profitable movie of all time. Show other people's butts in seats, quaking in fear. Part 1. The Ghost Dimension.
High def camera on. My girlfriend Katie, she thinks there's something in the house, I don't know.
You believe me, right?
I think I'm going to have a very interesting time capturing whatever paranormal phenomena is occurring or is not occurring. I'm hearing a weird sound.
Something's here. I feel it breathing on me.
In September 2009, a screening was held in Hollywood, California. This audience was among the first to experience the movie Paranormal Activity. This is what they saw. This is the way the Paranormal Activity trailer begins. We read that text as we watch audience members casually strolling to their seats. And then, as we see audience members shriek and recoil from the now familiar lo-fi night vision images, more flashes of text pop up, like this testimonial. The entire auditorium was freaked out of their minds. People were physically shaken. And the tagline, "Experience it for yourself." It's almost quaint to watch 6 years later, actually, because the entire framing device, the text explaining what you're about to see, the people walking to their seats, the way the footage from the movie is superimposed artificially onto a theater screen in front of the audience, also you get what's going on, that would all be completely unnecessary now. This is the lingua franca for horror marketing today, not just for other Jason Blum productions like Paranormal Activity sequels or The Gallows.
Audiences are having a terrifyingly good time.
But also for pricier horror films set in the past, like The Conjuring and The Woman in Black.
On January 18th, 250 people saw the special preview of The Woman in Black.
You've seen her, haven't you?
It was nonstop. My heart just kept racing.
At this point, if you see a night vision image of a couple with their hands over their eyes, jumping so hard popcorn kernels fall to the ground, you simply know what you're being told. Steel yourself.
Scariest movie I've ever seen.
I love the movie. I'm just not going to be able to sleep tonight.
My heart is still pounding.
I'm scared as hell.
It's an ideal strategy for the found footage boom. Horror cinema has been trending towards the more immediate for decades. What started as a genre built mostly on adaptations of 19th century gothic tales and spooky castles has transitioned quickly since the late 1960s to promising scares for the here and now. Possessions, hauntings, and murders are no longer reserved for the crumbling European manner of a brooding man with a dark secret. They could happen in a swanky New York apartment.
What have you done to its eyes?
On a quiet suburban street. Heck, maybe even in a 2-3 bedroom house.
That's the room my son and daughter used to occupy.
We believe it's the heart of the house.
This house has many hearts.
Just like yours. If you were, you know, the average moviegoer and not the small set of the population, I guess, that still broods over dark secrets and crumbly manners. And found footage horror takes this one step further. Instead of giving you the tools to muse, this could happen in my neighborhood, it negates the need for musing. This actually happened, it shouts. Films post-Blair Witch haven't quite hit on that movie's formula for fooling some of the populace into believing the events on screen actually occurred, or at least making it really fun for that populace to suspend disbelief for a few hours and pretend like they might believe, but the Paranormal Activity marketing strategy has been just as powerful. Because it almost becomes tough when watching a Paranormal Activity trailer to distinguish shots in the trailer that are from the actual movie
something going on across the street.
From similar night vision shots of theater patrons watching the movie. Everything is tinted that same gray-green. The introductory text, the grainy footage, it all combines to tell a story. If you can muster up the courage to see this horrifying thing, well, it'll be like you, yourself, are in a horror movie. Do you dare?
No! Too scary!
Jason Blum's world-conquering success as a producer is like William Castle's dream transformed from silly gimmickry into profitable formula.
I am William Castle, the director of the motion picture you're about to see. I feel obligated to warn you that some of the sensations, some of the physical reactions, which the actors on the screen will feel, will also be experienced for the first time in motion picture history by certain members of this audience.
Castle was a similarly profit-conscious producer who, in the 50s and 60s, wanted to turn the theater into a sensory onslaught, a funhouse that would grab you in concert with whatever was going on screen. When a skeleton approached on screen, one would fly over the audience. Castle would go so far as to actually jolt theater seats with vibrating motors to elicit screams when showing his film, The Tingler.
Unfortunate, sensitive people will at times feel a strange, tingling sensation. Others will feel it less strongly. But don't be alarmed. You can protect yourself. At any time you are conscious of a tingling sensation, you may obtain immediate relief by screaming.
At the end of Castle's lecture, we see audience members' faces emerge from the screen, shrieking in terror. Bloom and his directors have, 50 years later, made that promise of visceral thrills more convincing. We're now starting to see the audience reaction strategy falter a bit. Paranormal Activity: The Ghost Dimension is a pretty big disappointment. But for years, this promise of terror, see how terrified this big man is?
No! Too scared!
You're going to eat this up! Has seemed to lead directly to some of the genre's biggest profits ever. Audiences go in, expecting to feel what they see others feeling in the trailers, at regular intervals. And a Blumhouse production is built to deliver on that promise. Del Toro, however, is not particularly interested in playing the role of storyteller as vibrating motor timed to elicit jumps from the audience every 10 minutes. Faced with those expectations,
has anyone died in this house? Specific deaths, violent deaths.
Crimson Peak is a frustrating watch, to be sure. And while Crimson Peak's marketing doesn't go to the lengths of showing audience members cowering in fear, its 2015 appropriate crescendo into delirious, ghoulish pulse-pounding does little to prepare audiences for what Del Toro is actually willing to deliver. But here's the thing. This isn't a new problem.
There has never been a ghost story created especially for the adult moviegoer until... The Innocents.
Part 2. Haunted Mansions.
Do they ever return to possess the living?
We can go back as far as 1961 to see that paranormally tinged thrillers set on sprawling English estates have set their marketing to approximately, fever pitch.
The Innocents.
Even if the movies they're selling are, at the most, evocatively moody.
Do they ever return to possess the living?
Is what the trailer for The Innocents asks over and over again in a spooky voice that seems to imply, duh, they do. So you'd be hard-pressed to glean from the marketing that the answer may very well be, no. The Innocents is adapted from Henry James's 1898 novella, The Turn of the Screw.
Based on the Henry James chiller of macabre evil. Brilliantly adapted for the screen by William Archibald and Truman Capote.
It expertly preserves that novella's ambiguity, around which a century-long debate has circled. Is the new governess at Bly actually seeing ghosts who are possessing the two Muppets that are under her care? Or is she projecting her own insecurities onto relatively normal childhood behavior and hallucinating an elaborate ghost story?
All I want to do is save the children, not destroy them.
Accordingly, it is existentially terrifying to see our protagonist come apart at the seams, either failing to get anyone else to see what is actually there, or, even worse, doing something horrible to complete innocence based on her own psychosis. When the film is done, we're deeply troubled by what we just witnessed. But is it scary? You could ask the exact same question of another film that clearly draws inspiration from Henry James, 2001's The Others, which, as a ghost story released in the aughts, is about as far from Paranormal Activity as you can get. On first viewing, The Others, about a strict World War II mother, played by Nicole Kidman, who is caring for her light-sensitive children on a foggy British estate, is a moody puzzle box mystery. What is up with those unseen others that her daughter is consorting with?
Don't speak to them! Why? They're dead! What? They're ghosts! Please come here!
They're ghosts. Why aren't they wearing sheets and clanking chains?
On subsequent watches, once you have that oh moment, it is a character study of a deeply flawed individual who cannot cope with a dreadful realization. It could be described charitably as creepy, but it's never all that interested in jolting you out of your chair. both these films play a longer game. There may not be any particular moment where you're terrified, but you leave the theater with a perturbed queasiness that can last for days. That is hard to capture in marketing, especially when there are secrets and nuances you're trying to preserve for the paying audience. It's understandable why these trailers lean on the scariest moments to draw audiences in. Audiences wondering disappointingly why a scary trailer didn't lead them to a movie that delivers on the horror formula as we've come to expect it, it's not a problem unique to Crimson Peak. Which brings us to an interesting twist on our big question, whoever said Crimson Peak was going to be scary. Well, who says it isn't scary? Fear is subjective. It is based on an audience member's own disposition, the expectations that audience member brings into the tempest of fear, and their willingness to surrender to the artifice and accept artificial fear as a fun substitute for the real thing, which, you know, no one wants to actually experience. As for me, your trusty podcast narrator, my affection for the, let's call it the Halloween milieu, extends to Scooby-Doo, the Haunted Mansion, and those silly demon automatons you can buy at Walmart that wiggle or spout ghoulish puns when someone sets off their motion sensors. Those are fun.
This is a warning to all living mortals that whosoever opens this chest of demons will release 13 of the most terrifying ghosts upon the face of the earth.
When it came to fear, I needed go no further. There are moments in 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo and in Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island that have genuinely terrified me.
You won't get away with this!
I've been getting away with it for 200 years.
But you see, that goes towards expectations. We expect every villain in a Scooby story to be a spiteful janitor in a mask.
I'd have gotten away with it, too. If it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
So, when that is not the case, when the ghouls are real, we can experience just as much genuine fear as someone who goes to a Paranormal Activity film expecting all the jumps of a Paranormal Activity film. Also, I am easy to terrify. Until I was 16, I spent the majority of any journey in a doom buggy with my eyes shut and my fingers covering my ears, an instinct you will see I have not grown out of if you ever sit next to me in a movie theater while something horrible is being foreshadowed. Yep, there. There they go. There go my fingers creeping up towards my ears. I am that 6'1" guy with the beard, cradling his entire face in his hands with his giant shoulders hunched up at about eye level in some kind of movie theater seat fetal position.
When hinges creak in doorless chambers, and strange and frightening sounds echo through the halls, whenever candlelights flicker, where the air is deathly still, that is the time when ghosts are present, practicing their terror with ghoulish delight.
Admittedly, I have come around on the gothic, the twisted, and the grotesque. I've found the beauty in the aesthetics of the macabre. I now relish any visit to the Gracie Manor at the Magic Kingdom. It's my favorite thing in all of Orlando, bar none. But I will never confuse aesthetic appreciation for increased bravery. My instinct when confronted with fear is still flight. To run, to hide, to shut it out. You will never find me at Halloween Horror Nights. It's a line I will never cross. I simply have no need in my life for actors menacingly wielding chainsaws at me. I never will. Towing that line, finding that balance, it's something that the Imagineers who created the Haunted Mansion refined for years, moving from too scary to too light, too pristine to too ramshackle. To see what can happen when that balance is thrown off, look to the Eddie Murphy film of the same name. Its aesthetic borrows everything gorgeous about the British horror story. The ornate candelabras and trembling hands, the stone-faced housekeepers, dark-haired lords of the house with haunting secrets, the cobwebs and the portraits and the beautiful bluish glow of the phantasm. As a matter of fact, it fully commits to that aesthetic, pushing further than Walt, who insisted on keeping the outside of the mansion looking inviting, would ever let his Imagineers go. The filmmakers go full-on creepy bayou, a milieu which suits Rick Baker's makeup work beautifully. All of that explains why I have a continued fondness for that film, but unfortunately, Eddie Murphy thinks he's in Abbott and Costello Meet the Grim Grinning Ghosts.
And this history haunts these walls.
I don't think it's a good idea to put that information on the listing. People love bathrooms. We should play up the whole toilet angle. I think that'd be best.
He approaches the entire enterprise with a raised eyebrow that just doesn't match the film's actual stakes.
Dark spirits from the grave come forth.
Don't you make no dark spirits come out while I'm sitting there. Wait till I leave before the dark spirits come out.
He's like a tourist who knows it's all fake, in stark contrast with Edith Cushing in Crimson Peak, who is all too certain that what is happening is real.
Ghosts are real. That much I know.
And is all too willing to investigate to find out more.
Goodness, how many rooms are there?
I don't know. Would you like to count them?
This, I think, is the chief difference between the British ghost story and its modern American descendant. The British protagonist is a lone newcomer to a place with a long, dark, twisted past. A past which everyone, the butler, the maid, the gardener, the man of the house, the townspeople, all of them know it but the newcomer. This makes them inherently curious about the truth and makes them quick to get past the stage of disbelief. The American protagonists, because the horror formula usually dictates a collective, a family, a group of college co-eds on a road trip, they usually have arrived at a seemingly normal location, their new suburban home, a cabin in the woods, at which point they are assailed by a full coterie of ghouls. In the American version, the knowing housekeeper character has usually been replaced by a paranormal expert, brought in to info dump whatever quick hand wavy explanation needs info dumping. You know, oh yeah, that was an Indian burial ground.
These souls, who for whatever reason are not at rest, are also not aware that they have passed on. They're not part of consciousness as we know it. They linger in a perpetual dream state.
But the American protagonists usually dismiss this with something along the lines of, enough with the history lesson already, Professor. How do we get rid of the damn things? The quick acceptance and the curiosity are gone, and what we get instead is the standard middle-class family being punished until they can find some way to escape, or until they don't.
It's not the house, it's me.
You cannot run from this, it will follow you.
And this is how audiences approach these movies, as an assault, a crucible of fear, not as a mystery. They care as much about the reason for the haunting as the movies themselves do. And inevitably, the audience is disappointed when, with no other place to go, sequels delve back into the past to investigate who Reverend Kane is, or what exactly that coven of witches did to Katie and Christy. This is weird to the audience because these films were never about the past. But the British horror story is all about the past. It's carved into every stone, every ornate chandelier just quivers with it. It is a mystery meant to uncover the misdeeds of generations, the failed marriages, the shady dealings, the gruesome deaths. And it's easy to see why this has gone out of fashion, right? We, as a society, simply do not have the headspace for family estates that are handed down through the generations and the screwy marriages and loyal staffs that come with them anymore. To most Americans, this is a notion as lost to time as the high noon shootout, that you would pass down stately manors and castles to your ancestors for hundreds of years, or that to maintain this you had to marry a spouse and that spouse was supposed to be your forever spouse, come hell or high water. The houses we see in horror movies today do not have ancestral secrets. They were built 3 decades ago in a development boom. The family living there accidentally stumbled into something deeply wrong. If they had no part in kicking off the haunting, why would they stick around to see what the haunting really means? This may be the biggest place where Crimson Peak diverges from audience expectation. Edith is terrified by the ghosts, but is also savvy enough to realize, after a certain point, that they are trying to tell her about something even more sinister, about an awful past.
Mother, she looks quite horrible.
As Todd Vanderwerf at Vox points out, British ghost stories stand in stark contrast to movies with violent ghosts like Poltergeist and Paranormal Activity because ghosts are often incidental to the action. Yes, they're there, but they're a way of making the story's psychological subtext into text, the lurching reminders of the past that threaten to uncover long-buried secrets. This stems from the fact that in their traditional form, ghosts can't really hurt you. Look, for instance, at Del Toro's best film and richest ghost story, The Devil's Backbone. Even if the ghost in that film has moments where he's legitimately terrifying, he's still just a little boy, and his existence is a constant echo of the wartime reality the children in the film are forced to live through. The secrets of his creation don't weigh as heavily on the film as the sheer fact that these young boys have to live through the horrors of war. Tragedy, not horror. The tragedy of the past is everything in Crimson Peak, and it's no accident on Del Toro's part that our antagonists are old money Brits, beholden to hanging on to their ancestral estate no matter what. And our protagonists are new money Americans who wonder why these lords and ladies don't simply pick up and make a new start elsewhere. Which perfectly encapsulates the dichotomy of the old school and new school ghost stories. The old school is about a fear of the past resurfacing that comes with stagnancy, and the new school is about a fear of new beginnings that comes with mobility. Ultimately, regardless of the school, when it comes to this sort of story, we will go where our protagonist takes us, even to potential psychosis, if we invest in their plight. So even if the things which the protagonists of The Innocents, The Others, and Crimson Peak face aren't all that scary out of context, depending on your temperament, they are terrifying to the characters because of the larger quandaries they speak to. And so, if we in the audience do not become distracted or impatient waiting for cues to be scared, we can get a longer-lasting fright if we go along for the ride and throw our lots in with an Edith as she unravels the mysteries of a Crimson Peak. Speaking of rides...
Welcome, foolish mortals, to the Haunted Mansion. I am your host, your ghost host.
The Haunted Mansion, which Walt Disney once described in an interview with the BBC as an American retirement home for British ghosts displaced by the Blitz, shows us that on a daily basis, there is an audience out there that's giddy for a mild creep fest.
Of course, there's always my way.
They relish the vague outline of a hanged man on the ceiling, perhaps, a cackle and a pun.
Now, as they say, look alive.
But they don't approach horror as a game of crazed one-upsmanship. Look, there will always be hardcore gore hounds for whom Halloween Horror Nights would be the absolute worst because it's mere child's play, come on. And there will always be people like me for whom Halloween Horror Nights would be the absolute worst because intense scares and endorphin rushes just do not tingle the pleasure centers of our brain. We're all wired differently. The way I'm wired, Crimson Peak was plenty terrifying. There was no shortage of times where my hands were at my ears. But it was tolerable enough that I was able to appreciate Del Toro's grander mission, which is updating Gothic horror and Gothic romance, which were the reigning modes in the time of Laurence Olivier and Vincent Price, but were long ago thrown on the Hollywood dust heap with westerns, getting those back up to speed for the sensibilities of our time. Part 3, Heir Apparent.
In Gothic romance, mostly is sort of this princess-like figure falling in love with a Byronian dark gentleman, going to a crumbling mansion, which is a staple of Gothic. So this girl goes to that castle and discovers a horrible secret.
I mean, I think you feel about films like you feel about food in a way. You're looking for a different flavor now and then. And this is a flavor that is quite unique. It's like very exotic. And you haven't had it in so long. I mean, the last time I saw a proper lavish Gothic romance must have been 30, 40 years. So I felt it was good to bring it back into the sort of filmic conversation.
Lest we assume that storytellers like Guillermo del Toro, attempting to revive out-of-fashion genres like the Gothic romance that were once so oversaturated in the marketplace that they became something of a joke, lest we think that some newfangled 20th century phenomena. Although the passion for books of amusement founded on the marvelous, relative to ghosts and spirits, may be considered as having very much subsided, yet, I cannot but think that the tales which form the bulk of this little volume may still afford gratification in the perusal. From the period when the late Lord Orford first published The Castle of Otranto, till the production of Miss Radcliffe's romances, the appetite for the species of reading in question gradually increased. And perhaps it would not have been now surfeited, but for the multitude of contemptible imitations which the popularity of the latter writer called forth, and which continually issued from the press until the want of readers at length checked the inundation. This is perhaps the first thing that Lord Byron and his cohorts read aloud on the legendary night that Mary Shelley dreamt up, Frankenstein. It is the translator's introduction to Tales of the Dead, a collection of stories pulled from a longer French volume of German ghost stories called Phantasmagoriana. It is the book which, if Shelley's own count is to be believed, the reined-in guests at Byron's Villa Diodati used to kickstart the night of ghost stories that led to not only Frankenstein, but also a seminal text in the vampire genre and inspiration for Dracula, John William Polidori's The Vampire. This is a night so seminal in the annals of storytelling, there were two movies made about it within a two-year stretch in the 1980s, Haunted Summer and the frantic, free-associative, Freudian, very phallic Ken Russell film Gothic, both of which serve as a sort of corrective for film's most iconic portrayal of Mary Shelley in the prologue of The Bride of Frankenstein.
Possibly those thunders of proud dear Shelley. Heaven's applause for England's greatest poet.
What of my Mary?
She is an angel.
You think so?
You hear? Come, Mary. Come and watch the storm.
You know how lightning alarms me. Shelley, darling, will you please light these candles for me?
Oh, Mary, darling.
Astonishing creature.
Aye, Lord Byron.
Frightened of thunder, fearful of the dark, and yet you have written a tale that sent my blood into icy creeps. Look at her, Shelley. Can you believe that bland and lovely brow conceived of Frankenstein? A monster created from cadavers out of rifled graves? Isn't it astonishing?
I don't know why you should think so. What do you expect? Such an audience needs something stronger than a pretty little love story. So why shouldn't I write of monsters?
This is what we tend to lose over time. As people like Mary and Percy Shelley and Lord Byron become the literary establishment, foppishly rolling their R's, we lose touch with the fact that this was a group of people who did crazier things during that one rainy summer than I, along with most people, have done in a lifetime. The story of Frankenstein's creation is almost as vibrant off the page as it is on it. There's free love, there are affairs and exiles and rumored incest and possible, if not probable, drug use. Watching Ken Russell's Gothic and knowing that director's reputation for valuing his own vision for historical figures over portraying, I don't know, the things they actually did, you have to assume things like Percy Shelley running from the room screaming because the Phantasmagoriana makes him see a woman with eyes for nipples. That has to be a fabrication of Russell's vivid imagination, right? But nope. Dude really ran out of the room screaming because he was afraid of Miss Eye Nipples.
Look into my eyes.
And this is what happens to still revered authors like Shelley and Byron. What of their largely forgotten forebearers, like the previously name-checked Lord Orford and Anne Radcliffe? Consider the starting point for everything gothic that came after. They're mere trivia answers today. But Radcliffe's oeuvre was once a vivid enough part of discourse that Jane Austen wrote what amounts to a book-length satire of Radcliffe's work, in which a teenage girl expects the real world to behave the way the characters in her beloved gothic novels behave.
When we were coming to Northanger Abbey, you said that the house held secrets.
Did I? And have you discovered any dreadful revelations yet?
No, but I'd like to know what you meant.
I think that shall have to remain a secret. A secret once explained loses all of its charms and all of its danger, too. Why don't you imagine the worst thing you can and write your own gothic romance about it?
Northanger Abbey would make a very good title, don't you think?
Now you're mocking me.
That's a remarkably modern concept, and one that just as easily could apply to modern discourse around how troubling it is when readers find characters like Edward Cullen and Christian Grey innately romantic. One could see a Jane Austen of 2019 making a meta-film about how people swoon over Crimson Peak's Sir Thomas Sharpe, his last-minute defense of Edith, while, you know, forgetting that just because he looks like the world's Tumblr boyfriend Tom Hiddleston and truly did fall in love with this one girl, it kinda doesn't excuse the fact that he remorselessly killed the three previous girls that he didn't happen to fall in love with. Your Cullens and Greys and Sharps trace their lineage back directly to Lord Byron himself, who both wrote about men who were, quote-unquote, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, and was widely considered to embody all those traits himself. Actually, while it was obviously a big summer for gothic horror, most of what would come to define the dark recesses of gothic romance sat at Via Diodati that summer. Rochester was there. Obviously, Byron is the model for the brooding Byronic man with a secret, from Charlotte Bronte's Mr. Rochester to Daphne du Maurier's Maxim de Winter to Del Toro's Sir Thomas Sharpe. You have Thornfield, your sprawling setting that rings of the scandalous, with Vigia Diodati standing in for the doomed Thornfield, the doomed Manderley, and the doomed Allerdale / Crimson Peak. But you also have your Jane, your young heroine, deeply in love but struggling with the remnants of a former paramour. Because while Mary Shelley called herself Shelley at Via Diodati, she would not actually take that surname until later in 1816 when she married Percy Shelley. When she dreamt up Frankenstein, she was 18-year-old Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, traveling Europe with a man already married to a woman back in England. In this, we can actually read much of the anxiety that would later be explored when Jane Eyre found out about wife number one in the attic, when Rebecca's memory simply would not leave Manderley, and when Edith Cushing discovered what the Sharp siblings had done at Crimson Peak three times before. So, let the record show that Mary Shelley, like most of the authors behind the books that make up our high school syllabi, was much more interesting a character than history has flattened her into. We have a tendency, on the whole, to Downton Abbey-ify the past. Nostalgia for a time period makes it sumptuous, wholesome, and clean. And, potentially, a bit dull. For the record, I don't find Downton Abbey dull. I really like Downton Abbey.
I'm tougher than I look. You're a treasure.
I have not been innocent when it comes to that habit. I'll admit that Jane Eyre, Charlotte Bronte's gothic romance, is the book that broke me. I found it unbearably dull, which is odd because in their time, the Bronte sisters' novels, written under the pseudonyms of the Bell brothers, were the height of scandal. They were audacious, misunderstood, decried. None of that got to me in 2003. In ninth grade, Jane Eyre is the novel that convinced me that there would be books on my syllabus that I would simply not get. And the only reason to read, to skim those books was to make it look like I'd read them. I didn't truly get Jane Eyre until doing research for this episode. I went on Netflix and pulled up the 2011 Cary Fukunaga film starring Edith Cushing herself, Mia Wasikowska.
Who would you offend by living with me? Who would care?
I would.
You'd rather drive me to madness than break some mere human law.
I must respect myself.
Suddenly, with Wasikowska playing against Michael Fassbender, the text was unlocked. What I think I needed to see was an interpretation that forfeited sumptuousness in order to capture the real peopleness of Eyre's characters, and against that ordinariness, the extraordinariness of the situations they find themselves in, could finally flourish. Fukunaga forgoes most of the trappings of the costume drama, which is what we inevitably turn books from a century ago into. He elects to use gorgeously understated natural light whenever possible. He makes sure Thornfield looks like an actual manor house rather than a collection of elaborate sets. Costumes and whatever makeup there is highlight the characters' stations in life rather than highlighting some innate beauty of the time period. And the performances he draws out are quiet.
You altogether are a human being, Jane.
I conscientiously believe so.
Sometimes, whispered.
The dream.
This is emblematic of a recent trend in 19th century literary adaptations, possibly informed by the artistic inclinations of a new generation of directors, or possibly influenced by lower budgets that correspond to a smaller audience for adult market films, who knows. In the 90s, adaptations like Coppola's Dracula and Branagh's Frankenstein were elaborate productions that advertised faithfulness to the text. Today, you get something more along the lines of what has been done to Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, both on the radio and on the big screen. In 2011, Jonathan Holloway staged a controversial BBC radio adaptation that added cursing and racial slurs to Bronte's text.
For me, Wuthering Heights is a story of violent obsession and a torturous, unfulfilled relationship. This is not a Vaseline-lensed experience. That's what I wanted to elbow out. This idea that it's the cozy, greatest love story ever told. It's not, you know? The F-words are part of my attempt to shift the production to left field and to help capture the shock that was associated with the original book when it was published.
Well, if that's the case, Holloway might have liked Andrea Arnold's film. She also includes prodigious swaths of swears. When her characters speak, they sound like what lower-class rural Brits might have actually sounded like in the 1840s, and not like what publishing standards of the time would allow. Just as often, they don't speak at all. Arnold includes long passages of utter and complete silence of young Heathcliff and Catherine frolicking, wrestling, just sitting out in the moor, covered in filth and grime, staring out into the horizon. This adaptation is not heavy on dialogue. Heathcliff especially is usually either mute or engaged in intense swear-offs with Hindley. The adaptation does not shy away from Heathcliff's more monstrous actions either. It certainly does not posit that there are upright, rational ways to handle lovesickness and jealousy. But
it adds previously unmined depths in the text by casting the gypsy not with a swashbuckling white actor like Tom Hardy.
When I heard that you were to marry, I had one thought in my head I would return. Have one glimpse of your face. Settle my score with Hindley, then prevent the law by executing myself. Now I see I should have stuck to my call.
But with a set of mixed-race actors, James Howson and Solomon Glaive. With this interpretation of Bronte's descriptions of Heathcliff as dark-skinned and as a little Lascar, Heathcliff's treatment at the hands of others, it makes renewed sense, and it speaks to the issues of our time in a way an adaptation about a Lily White gypsy is unlikely to do. This is the challenge, to find ways to make the past come alive, a challenge which Del Toro was aware of when he decided he wanted to make his own Jane Eyre for a 2015 audience, a challenge he relished.
The idea was to replicate the effect that Gothic romance novels had in the 1800s when they were read in Victorian parlors. You know, you have the parlor ladies reading the novel and sort of very, very titillated. And it was because the sex and the violence in those novels was extreme for the time. So you need to replicate sort of this overwrought melodramatic arch.
How do you titillate the modern audience with Gothic romance? Make them understand the scandalousness that haunts its heart? Now that things like multiple marriages in and of themselves are sort of the norm. Well, Del Toro takes the road Arnold and Fukunaga did not. He leans hard into costume drama. So hard, Crimson Peak becomes gaudy with lavish costumes and set dressings. Delightfully gaudy, the kind of gaudiness we haven't seen since the heyday of Roger Corman and Vincent Price.
Any sort of food more exotic than the most pallid mash is unendurable to my taste buds.
Allerdale seems to have borrowed the same interior decorator that did the House of Usher, the guy that said, you know, this house seems pretty spooky. Let's go ahead and accentuate that by making everything black, gray, crimson will be good, let's put that everywhere, and a nice iridescent green. Del Toro even uses Corman's Technicolor strategy to set Edith apart from her surroundings. In Corman's 1960 adaptation of Poe's short story Fall of the House of Usher, which is a very loose adaptation, considering it adds on a Gothic romance where none had this space to exist in Poe's work, our protagonist is always clad in a nice calming blue, in a house with a color scheme that wouldn't know what to do with a blue if it took an entire college course on the color. Edith, similarly, is a cream-colored daydream in a house that's dressed like a nightmare. She is the hue we would expect from a ghost, while the ghosts turn out to be the vibrant crimson of the movie's title. They are pure gore. Floating viscera contorted into unnatural shapes.
The design of the ghosts responded to the general color palette of the movie, being the only red thing other than the clay and Lucille, connecting them, the three of them. The aspect of them was inspired by a book I read as a kid that had bug mummies, you know, these mummified corpses that are pressed by the black clay. So I thought, let's use them with the red clay, but make them be striking, sort of beautiful in a very creepy way.
Del Toro doesn't want natural light, natural makeup, natural sounding language. His sensibility here is to saturate, to heighten, to make subtext text, to fully explore the Gothic horror in the Gothic romance. It's actually quite disingenuous for Del Toro to say Crimson Peak isn't a horror film and is a Gothic romance. It is both, which is actually quite a natural progression. First, Jane Eyre, right? In 1847, Thornfield's potential haunting ends up being easily explicable by physical reality. Rochester's greatest sin is lying to Jane, which sucks, but on the whole, he proves to be a decent, valiant enough dude who even attempts saving his mad wife at great cost to himself. And anything truly outré or risqué is deeply subtextual. All the same, symbolically, Thornfield cannot be a safe place to start a new future. It must burn. and it does. Now moving forward to Rebecca. In 1938, Rebecca's hold over Manderley is no longer physical, it's feverishly psychological, if not quite spectral yet. Maxime has killed, but it's viewed somewhat sympathetically considering Rebecca's true nature and her secret, and the Hays Code ends up absolving him of this crime in Hitchcock's 1940 film anyway. And the risque nature of Miss Danvers' obsession with Rebecca is much less subtextual. It's almost implied, though Miss Danvers does, symbolically, need to be punished for the implication.
Stand behind her like this, brush away for 20 minutes at a time. And then she would say, "Good night, Danny," and step into her bed. I embroidered this case for her myself, and I keep it here always.
Just as in Jane Eyre and in Fall of the House of Usher, the scandals suit the times, and in the end, the manor itself must pay the price.
The land withered as before a plague.
Plague?
Yes, Mr. Winthrop. A plague of evil. Anthony Usher. Thief, usurer, merchant of flesh. Bernard Usher, swindler, forger, jewel thief, drug addict.
Like Thornfield before it, and like the cinematic House of Usher, Manderley is set aflame and destroyed. It takes a violent, jarring incident to separate our hero and heroine from the unseemly sight that housed all those indiscretions. The past is finally left in the past.
I looked upon a desolate shell, with no whisper of the past about its staring walls. We can never go back to Manderley again, that much is certain. But sometimes, in my dreams, I do go back.
Crimson Peak, then, becomes the logical extension of this trend line for 2015. The ghosts that haunt Sir Thomas Sharp's past aren't actual ladies in the attic or psychological roadblocks. They are genuine ghosts, spooky ghosts. Thomas may perform one sympathetic action to prove his true love, but he is, in every other sense, a monster, if not quite the monster his sister is. And there is nothing subtextual or implied about the risque in Crimson Peak. Del Toro shows you exactly what's really going on. With this comes an even more haunting ending, one that does not simply wash away the past in flames. Crimson Peak is not set alight, is not destroyed. Instead, while our American heroes who are willing to exercise mobility make their escape, we see that the Sharps are now really and truly stuck at Allerdale. Lucille and Thomas Sharp are monstrous because they cannot let go of the past. They cannot let go of a grudge against their parents. They cannot let go of their ancestral home, even though it has a hole in its roof and clay leaking through the floorboards. And they cannot let go of each other. They will go to extraordinary lengths to hold on to Crimson Peak forever. And, in a way, in the end, they get their wish. Which is just really good writing. So, in honor of Mr. Del Toro, righting a wrong. Crimson Peak is a horror film, yes, but it may not be the horror film you expect. It has different motives, different ancestors. It is about the past. Is there a way to tell a story about a slavish, grotesque attachment to the past without a genre people don't inherently get these days, like gothic romance? Without ghosts? Well, sure, I guess. But when you come at it from that perspective, why would you want to see a different approach when the result of Del Toro's approach is Crimson Peak?
Hurry back, hurry back.
Charles Gustin, and I write, edit, and produce iconography myself. And I feel like I should say the same about Context Sensitive, which you just heard. It was tough to put all the time into a podcast as labor-intensive as Context Sensitive was and not have any audience to speak of, so I am so grateful that you're taking the time to listen to iconography. If you like what you've been hearing, be sure to subscribe in iTunes and to rate and review the podcast. It really does help to get the word out. Are there any icons you'd like to hear more about as we gear up for 2017? You can tweet at me at Charles Gustine, that's CharlesGustine, or please do visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/iconographypodcast. And be sure to check out the website for pictures, videos, and audio clips. That's iconographypodcast.squarespace.com. Next time, for the first time in a very long time, the lights are out in Piccadilly Circus. The iconic 6 LED billboards that curve around the northeast corner of the circus are currently being replaced by one massive screen. When the lights go down in the city. Now, ordinarily, when a destination as popular as Piccadilly changes in any way, people freak out. But Piccadilly is different. It's always been about the grand idea of progress, about the new, about what's next, more than it's ever been about any particular building or sign. So next time, Piccadilly Circus.